Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into a subject that is absolutely fundamental, I mean, really the bedrock of patient care, especially if you're navigating the challenging and incredibly rewarding world of nursing right now.
Absolutely. And, you know, the source material for this Deep Dive comes from a chapter specifically dedicated to this critical topic, fluid and electrolytes.
Right.
Think of this information as your, well, your essential toolkit for understanding one of the body's most vital and, frankly, delicate balancing acts.
And our mission together right now is to unpack that toolkit for you. We're going to go beyond just, you know, listing facts.
Yeah.
We're going to extract the most important nuggets, shine a light on why this stuff is so incredibly vital for anyone caring for patients,
mm-hmm.
and really focus on your unique role as a nurse, anticipating, identifying, and responding when this critical balance starts to waver.
Precisely. We'll explore the body's complex internal environment, the, well, ingenious ways it tries to keep things stable. What happens when that stability is threatened by illness or injury? And crucially, how your sharp observations and timely interventions can make a profound difference in a patient's outcome.
Okay, let's unpack this and understand what's really going on beneath the surface.
So let's start with the absolute core principle highlighted in the source material.
Yeah.
Why does fluid and electrolyte balance matter so much? It is stated right away. It is absolutely necessary for life and maintaining homeostasis.
Homeostasis, right, that internal equilibrium.
Exactly. It's the body's constant effort to maintain a stable internal environment despite, you know, external changes, like your internal thermostat constantly making these micro adjustments.
Right. It's that vital equilibrium. If things get out of whack, systems start to fail. And the source emphasizes your role as a nurse here.
Yes.
You are key in anticipating, identifying, and responding to possible imbalances. This isn't just about spotting a problem after it's already glaringly obvious.
No.
It's about being proactive. For you, learning nursing, this is where you connect the dots between foundational science and real-world patient scenarios. It's about seeing the subtle cues that tell you something might be going wrong, allowing you to intervene before a crisis develops.
Exactly. Your ability to assess, to be vigilant, and to understand the underlying why is what elevates your care. Now, to grasp the balance, we first have to understand the fluid itself.
Mm-hmm.
The source reminds us that fluid isn't just one big pool. It's distributed in different compartments throughout the body.
On average, fluid makes up about 60% of a typical adult's body weight. But that percentage isn't static, is it?
Not at all. It varies depending on age. Babies have more, older adults less body fat because fat tissue has less water than lean tissue,
right,
and gender. Knowing this variability helps you understand why certain patient populations are just more vulnerable to fluid shifts.
And as you mentioned, this fluid is compartmentalized. The largest compartment is the intracellular fluid, or ICF.
That's the fluid within the cells. It makes up about 2/3 of the total body fluid volume, and it's primarily found within your skeletal muscle mass.
So, okay, the first big insight here is that most of your patient's body fluid isn't even in their bloodstream where you're drawing labs.
Exactly.
It's inside their cells. That helps explain why just checking blood values doesn't give the whole picture of hydration and why fluid shifts into or out of cells are so critical.
Absolutely. The other main compartment is the extracellular fluid, or ECF. This is all the fluid outside the cells, making up the remaining 1/3 of total body fluid.
And the ECF has its own subdivisions, right? First, there's the intravascular fluid.
Mm-hmm. That's the fluid contained within your blood vessels. It's essentially the plasma, the liquid component of your blood containing erythrocytes, leukocytes, and thrombocytes, your circulating blood volume.
Then you have the interstitial fluid.
Right. This fluid surrounds the cells, filling the spaces between them. The source mentions lymph as an example. This is the fluid that, you know, bathes your tissues. Think of it as the fluid that nutrients and oxygen from the blood pass through to reach the cells.
Okay.
And waste products pass through to get back into the blood.
And finally, the smaller specialized compartment, transcellular fluid.
Yeah, this is found in specific limited spaces like cerebrospinal fluid cushioning your brain and spinal cord, pericardial fluid around your heart, synovial fluid lubricating your joints, and fluid in pleural and peritoneal cavities. While it's small in volume, these fluids are absolutely essential for specific functions.
So you have this intricate network of fluid spaces.
Mm-hmm.
But what's in this fluid? That's where electrolytes come in.
Yes. These are described as active chemicals that carry electrical charges. They are absolutely essential for numerous body functions.
And they carry either a positive charge, making them protonations, or a negative charge, anions.
The major cations listed are sodium Na plus, potassium K plus, calcium Ca2 plus, magnesium Mg2 plus, and hydrogen ions H plus.
And the major anions are chloride, Cl, bicarbonate, HCO3, phosphate, PO43, sulfate, SO42, and negatively charged protein ions.
Their concentration in body fluids is expressed in milliequivalents MEQ per liter.
Right, which measures their chemical combining power, not just weight.
Exactly. It tells you how many electrical charges are available to participate in chemical reactions. Now, here's another crucial insight. The concentrations of these electrolytes are vastly different inside the cells, ICF, compared to outside the cells, ECF.
Okay.
For example, sodium is the major cation outside the cell, while potassium is the major cation inside the cell. This concentration difference across the cell membrane isn't just a fact. It's the engine that drives critical cellular processes like nerve impulse transmission, muscle contraction, maintaining cell volume.
Wow.
Without these gradients, cells just can't function properly.
That difference is like storing energy in a battery. One side has more charge than the other, creating the potential for work.
That's a great analogy. And the body works incredibly hard to maintain these differences. Which brings us to how the body regulates fluid and electrolytes. It's a complex symphony of mechanisms.
So fluid movement between these compartments isn't random, right? Mm-hmm. It follows principles driven by concentration and pressure gradients. The source details several key ones. First, osmosis.
The diffusion of water. Water moves from an area where there are fewer salt, less stuff dissolved, to an area where there are more solutes, more stuff dissolved across a semipermeable membrane.
Uh-huh.
The body uses this principle constantly to shift water and maintain fluid balance.
Like a raisin dropped in water, water moves into the raisin because it has a higher solute concentration.
Good analogy. Then there's diffusion. This is the movement of the solutes themselves.
Okay.
Solutes move from an area of higher concentration to an area of lower concentration. Like if you spray air freshener in one corner of a room, it diffuses until the smell is spread throughout.
And filtration, which is driven by pressure.
Yes. The movement of water in solutes from an area of hydrostatic pressure to an area of low hydrostatic pressure.
Hydrostatic pressure.
Yeah.
That's the pressure exerted on the walls of the blood vessels by the fluid itself. The pushing pressure.
Exactly. And opposing this is osmotic pressure, also called colloid osmotic pressure, which is the pulling pressure created by proteins, primarily albumin, in the plasma.
Okay.
So fluid moving out of capillaries into the interstitial space to deliver nutrients and then back in to remove waste depends on the balance between these pushing hydrostatic and pulling osmotic forces.
And when that balance is off, you see problems like edema.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So pressure pushes things out of vessels, proteins pull them back in, and osmosis pulls water based on how much stuff is dissolved. But some things need active help to cross that cell membrane barrier, even against the flow, right?
Right. Active transport.
That's active transport. This process requires energy in the form of ATP because it moves substances against their concentration gradient. The classic example, and one of the most energy-consuming processes in the body, is the sodium-potassium pump.
Ah, the famous pump.
Yes. This pump constantly moves sodium out of the cell and potassium into the cell, maintaining those vital concentration differences we discussed. It's like a persistent little bouncer at the cellular doorway.
And it works tirelessly. So with all this movement, how does the body ensure the overall volume and concentration stays within normal limits?
Well, in healthy individuals, the body is remarkably good at balancing intake and output. Daily fluid gains from drinking and eating are typically equal to daily fluid losses.
Where does fluid leave the body?
The primary pathway is the kidneys via urine output. And the source highlights a key indicator for kidney function and overall fluid status, a urine output of 1 LLT CHR.
1 mL per kilogram per hour. That's a crucial number for nurses, isn't it?
Absolutely. Write that down if you're studying. It's a simple, real-time assessment telling you if the kidneys are perfusing adequately and handling the fluid load.
Got it. 1 mL/kL, minimum urine output. What are the other loss pathways?
Other pathways include the skin, both sensible loss through visible sweating, like with exercise or fever, and insensible loss you don't perceive, which increases with fever, exercise, or burns. The lungs also contribute about 300 milliliters of insensible loss daily just through breathing, and that increases with faster respiration rates.
Okay.
And the GI tract, while normally very efficient at reabsorbing fluid, can become a major source of loss in conditions like severe diarrhea or with things like GI suctioning or fistulas.
So the kidneys are the main regulators, but skin, lungs, and the GI tract are also points where the body interacts with the environment regarding fluid.
Right. And maintaining this intricate balance isn't just about passive movement and intake output. It involves a sophisticated network of homeostatic mechanisms involving multiple organs and hormones. The source lists several key players.
Okay, like the kidneys, obviously. The master filters and regulators, adjusting what's kept and what's excreted.
Yes, and the heart and blood vessels are crucial for sensing volume and pressure changes and distributing fluid throughout the body.
The lungs, besides insensible loss, play a role in acid-base balance, which is intertwined with electrolytes like bicarbonate and chloride.
Mm-hmm. The pituitary gland releases antidiuretic hormone, ADH.
ADH, the water conservation signal.
Exactly. It tells the kidneys to reabsorb more water. Then the adrenal glands produce aldosterone.
Aldosterone holds on to sodium, and water follows sodium, right? And it makes you excrete potassium.
Spot on. The parathyroid glands regulate calcium and phosphate levels. Baroreceptors in the large blood vessels sense changes in blood pressure and signal the brain to adjust heart rate or vessel tone.
And the big one. The renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, or RAAS. This is the body's powerful response to low blood pressure or volume.
It's a cascade of hormones that ultimately leads to vasoconstriction tightening blood vessels and increased aldosterone release, resulting in increased sodium and water reabsorption by the kidneys.
So that's the body's emergency response.
Absolutely. The key insight here for you as a nurse is understanding that this system is the body's emergency response to low volume or pressure. When your patient is hypotensive, the RAAS is kicking in hard to hold on to fluid and constrict vessels. And often our interventions, like giving fluids or certain medications, are aimed at supporting or sometimes counteracting this very powerful system.
Got it. What else is involved? Osmoreceptors.
Yes, osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus sense, changes in serum osmolality, basically, how concentrated the blood is and trigger thirst or ADH release to correct it.
And finally, natriuretic peptides.
Right, hormones released by the heart in response to stretching, like from increased volume. These peptides, ANP and BNP, promote sodium and water excretion, helping to counteract fluid overload.
Wow, that's a lot of complex systems working together. It really underscores how the body has multiple backup plans to try and maintain that balance.
It does. And understanding how these systems work helps you anticipate what the body might do when faced with an imbalance and why certain symptoms or lab results appear.
Now, while these principles are universal, the source points out some critical special considerations, particularly for the gerontologic patient. This is where it gets really interesting and clinically relevant.
Oh, definitely. Because the clinical manifestations of fluid and electrolyte imbalances can be surprisingly subtle in older adults compared to younger patients.
This is a vital point for you to be vigilant about at the bedside. Fluid deficit, for example.
Right. It might not present with the classic signs you expect, like obvious thirst or a significant drop in blood pressure initially. Instead, the first sign could be a sudden onset of confusion or delirium.
Which you might mistake for something else if you're not thinking dehydration.
Exactly. You might think it's dementia or another issue if you're not actively considering dehydration as a possibility.
That's a huge difference in presentation and could delay crucial fluid resuscitation.
And older adults often have decreased cardiac reserve. Their hearts just can't pump as hard or fast to compensate for low volume.
Right.
And their renal function is often reduced, impacting their ability to either conserve or excrete fluid and electrolytes effectively. Their bodies just have less ability to bounce back from stress.
Dehydration is very common in this population,
it's
isn't
very
it?
Very common. Often due to a blunted thirst sensation, physical limitations that make accessing fluids difficult, or side effects of multiple medications they might be taking.
The source also mentions age-related skin changes, thinning skin, loss of elasticity.
Mm-hmm. Which makes assessing skin turgor for hydration status less reliable. They might have tenting, even when well hydrated, simply due to age.
Plus, it makes IV insertion and ongoing site monitoring more challenging.
Definitely. Increases the risk of skin tears or complications. So the lesson here is that while the imbalance is the same, the way an older adult's body responds and presents signs requires a higher index of suspicion and tailored assessment techniques. You need to be extra observant and look beyond the typical textbook presentation.
Okay, let's move from the ideal state and specific populations to what happens when the balance goes wrong. The source focuses on the two main fluid volume imbalances, fluid volume deficit, or FVD.
Also known as hypovolemia, having too little fluid.
And fluid volume excess, or FDE.
Hypervolemia, having too much fluid.
All right, let's break down fluid volume deficit hypovolemia first.
Mm-hmm.
This means you don't have enough fluid in those key compartments, especially the intravascular space, right?
Yeah.
Affecting circulating volume.
Exactly.
What pulls that fluid out or prevents intake?
Mm-hmm.
The causes listed include significant fluid losses like vomiting, diarrhea, or GI suctioning.
Mm-hmm. Excessive sweating, like from fever or intense exercise. Lack of access to fluids. Maybe someone is MPO, weak, or confused and just can't drink.
And a critical cause is third spacing.
Third spacing. This is when fluid shifts out of the intravascular space into areas that don't help maintain circulating volume.
Like where?
Like the peritoneal cavity causing ascites, or the pleural space causing a pleural effusion, or into burned tissue or large swollen joints. Diabetes insipidus, that hormonal problem affecting ADH, can cause massive water loss. And obviously, hemorrhage is a direct loss of blood and thus intravascular fluid.
So how does a patient with FED look at the bedside? What are the clinical manifestations and diagnostics we should watch for?
Well, your body tries to compensate for low volume. So you'll see signs like acute weight loss. That's a sensitive indicator.
Okay.
Decreased skin turgor is classic. Although remember the caveat with older adults. Urine output will likely be low, oliguria, and concentrated dark yellow as the kidneys try to conserve water.
That 1 mL K for each jar benchmark again.
Exactly. Capillary refill time will be slow, more than 3 seconds, showing poor peripheral perfusion.
Central venous pressure, CVP, would be low. Neck veins look flat, not distended, especially when the patient is lying flat.
Right. Patients might feel dizzy or weak, especially when sitting or standing orthostatic hypotension. Their heart rate will increase, tachycardia, as the heart pumps faster to try and circulate the reduced volume. They might complain of muscle cramps. Their skin might feel cool, clammy, and appear pale as blood flow is prioritized to core organs.
And lab values, they'd show hemoconcentration.
Often, yes. Hemoglobin and hematocrit, HGB-HCT, will be increased relative to the baseline because the liquid plasma volume is low. Serum and urine osmolality and specific gravity will be increased, indicating concentrated fluids. BUN and creatinine may be elevated, suggesting reduced kidney perfusion due to low volume.
So the clinical picture is the body sounding alarm bells about low volume, pulling fluid from everywhere and shunting blood flow. How is this managed medically?
The goal is to restore volume. Intravenous fluids are the cornerstone. Initially, isotonic solutions like lactated ringers or 0.9% sodium chloride, normal saline, are preferred.
Why isotonic?
Because they stay primarily in the intravascular space, directly increasing circulating volume. Once the patient is more stable, hypertonic solutions like 0.45% ACL might be used to rehydrate the cells themselves.
And addressing the underlying cause, stopping the vomiting, treating the diarrhea, controlling bleeding.
Absolutely. And if the patient can tolerate it, encouraging oral fluids is the simplest and most natural way to rehydrate.
As for nursing management, the source emphasizes key interventions, monitoring INOs meticulously.
Yes, sometimes hourly in critical situations, or at least every 8 hours, is essential to quantify losses and gains.
Frequent vital sign monitoring provides real-time feedback on the body's compensatory efforts.
And watching urine output closely, volume, color, and specific gravity gives you direct insight into kidney function and hydration status.
So that's the too little side. What about fluid volume excess, hypervolemia having too much fluid?
This happens when the body retains excess fluid, often in the ECF compartments, including the intravascular space.
What causes this? The source lists conditions where the body can't excrete fluid properly, like kidney injury or failure.
Heart failure, where the pump isn't strong enough to move fluid forward effectively, leading to backup. Cirrhosis of the liver, which impairs protein production and fluid balance regulation.
It can also be caused by receiving too much IV fluid, especially sodium-containing solutions, too quickly.
Right. Burns can lead to FEE during the resuscitation phase after the initial third spacing. Even stress can contribute to fluid retention through hormonal responses.
And the clinical manifestations of hypervolemia are quite different from FED.
Yes, you'll see signs of volume overload. Acute weight gain is a hallmark sign. Peripheral edema, swelling in the arms, legs, feet is common as excess fluid is pushed into the interstitial space.
Ascites, fluid in the abdomen, can occur. Neck veins might be distended, even when the patient is sitting upright, indicating increased intravascular volume and pressure, so an elevated CVP.
You'll hear crackles or rails in the lungs on auscultation as fluid shifts into the tiny air sacs, the alveoli. Patients will often report shortness of breath, SOB.
Blood pressure will likely be increased, and the pulse might feel strong and bounding due to the increased circulating volume.
They might have a cough, breathe faster, tachypnea, and depending on the cause, might have increased urine output as the kidneys try to get rid of the excess, unless, of course, the FEV is due to kidney failure.
And the labs would show hemodilution.
Correct. Decreased hemoglobin and hematocrit, HGB-HCT, because there's more fluid volume relative to the red cells. Serum and urine osmolality and specific gravity will be decreased because the fluids are diluted.
How is hypervolemia managed medically?
The primary goal is to reduce the excess fluid. This involves restricting both fluid intake and sodium intake, as sodium holds onto water.
Diuretics.
Yes, diuretics, especially loop diuretics like furosemide, are commonly used to increase urine output. But you need to monitor closely for potential electrolyte losses, particularly potassium and magnesium, with diuretics. In severe refractory cases, dialysis may be necessary to remove fluid. Low-sodium diets are essential, and teaching patients about hidden sodium and cautioning them about salt substitutes, which often contain potassium, is really important.
And nursing management for hypervolemia.
Monitoring INOs remains critical to track removal of excess fluid. Auscultating breath sounds frequently for crackles is vital to catch pulmonary congestion early.
Mm-hmm.
Monitoring and assessing peripheral edema helps you gauge the effectiveness of interventions. Bed rest is often recommended as it promotes diuresis by improving blood flow to the kidneys and helps reduce edema by reducing gravitational effects.
So for both FVD and FVE, your assessment skills, weighing the patient, checking skin, listening to lungs, measuring INOs, monitoring vital signs are your primary tools at the bedside to recognize these problems and evaluate your interventions.
Absolutely foundational. And a very common intervention you'll be performing as a nurse is intravenous therapy, delivering fluids, medications, or blood products directly into the bloodstream.
Yeah, understanding the different types of IV solutions is essential for safe administration.
It really is. This comes down to tonicity, how concentrated the solution is compared to body fluids, and how it affects cell volume.
Okay, so let's start with hypotonic solutions.
Hypertonic solutions have a lower solute concentration than body fluids. Examples include 0.45% ACL, which is half normal saline, or D5W, 5% dextrose in water after the body metabolizes the glucose, leaving just water.
Okay, so what's their purpose?
Their purpose is to cause cells to swell by pulling fluid into the cells. They are used to hydrate cells or to treat conditions where the ECF is too concentrated, like severe hypernatremia.
Okay, so hypotonic makes cells plump up, pulling fluid into them. Isotonic solutions.
Isotonic solutions have an osmolality similar to ECF. Examples are 0.9% ACL normal saline or lactated ringers and D5W in the IV bag.
These are the volume expanders.
Exactly. They don't cause significant fluid shifts into or out of cells. They stay primarily in the intravascular space, which is why they are the go-to solutions for treating hypovolemia and expanding circulating volume.
And hypertonic solutions. Higher solute concentration than body fluids.
Right. Examples include 3% ACL, mannitol, or D50W 50% dextrose in water.
What do they do?
These solutions pull fluid out of cells and into the ECF, causing cells to shrink. They are used cautiously in specific situations like severe symptomatic hyponatremia.
To pull water out of swollen brain cells.
Exactly, or to treat cerebral edema with mannitol. They carry a risk of fluid overload if given too quickly or in large amounts, so you have to be careful.
The source also mentions other solutions like packed red blood cells, PRBCs, albumin, and plasma.
Yeah, these aren't defined by simple tonicity in the same way. PRBCs are given to improve oxygen-carrying capacity in patients with low HGB-HCT.
Right.
Albumin and plasma are colloids. They contain large protein molecules that stay in the intravascular space and exert significant osmotic pressure, effectively pulling fluid from the interstitial space into the blood vessels. They are very effective volume expanders, especially when a patient has low protein levels contributing to fluid shifts.
So the choice of IV solution is a critical decision based on the patient's specific imbalance. And the goal of therapy, do you need to add volume to the bloodstream, hydrate cells, or pull fluid out of cells?
Exactly. And once that IV is running, your job isn't done. The source highlights that maintaining an infusion system and assessing the infusion site frequently for local complications are critical, high-priority nursing responsibilities.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the potential problems listed. First, air embolism. This one sounds serious.
It is. Air entering the bloodstream can be life-threatening, often associated with central lines or improper priming or changing of tubing.
What are the signs and symptoms?
Sudden palpitations, difficulty breathing, dyspnea, a persistent cough, jugular vein distension, JVD, wheezing, cyanosis, hypotension, a weak and rapid pulse, altered mental status, and maybe pain in the chest, shoulder, or low back.
If you suspect that, what's the immediate nursing action?
Cystopy the infusion immediately. The source specifically directs you to position the patient on their left side and in Trendelenburg, head down.
Why that position?
This position helps trap the air bubble in the right ventricle, preventing it from traveling to the lungs. Then you assess the patient fully and administer oxygen.
Left side, Trendelenburg, critical positioning to remember for suspected air embolism. What about systemic infection?
This can occur if there's contamination of the IV fluid itself, or if strict aseptic technique isn't followed during insertion or care. Signs are systemic, elevated temperature, backache, headache, general malaise, tachycardia, tachypnea, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, chills, shaking. You'd also likely see local signs at the site.
Okay, moving to those local complications right at the site, which you should be checking every time you see the patient. Phlebitis is first.
Phlebitis is inflammation of the vein. It can be caused by chemical irritation from the IV solution or medication, mechanical irritation from the catheter moving around in the vein, or bacterial infection.
What does it look and feel like?
You'll see redness and warmth at the insertion site, pain or tenderness along the path of the vein, and possibly some swelling. The source mentions it's often graded on a scale to indicate severity.
How do you manage phlebitis?
Discontinue the IV line immediately. Apply a warm, moist compress to the area to help reduce inflammation and soothe the vein.
Prevention is key here, right?
Absolutely. Regular site assessment is your best defense. Use strict aseptic technique for insertion and anytime you access the line. Choose an appropriate catheter size for the vein and the type of solution being infused. Some solutions are just too irritating for peripheral veins and require central access.
Next local issue, infiltration.
Infiltration is when a non-vesicant solution, meaning it won't cause severe tissue damage, accidentally goes into the subcutaneous tissue surrounding the vein instead of into the vein itself.
What are the signs you'd see at the site?
The area around the site will look swollen or enlarged. It will feel cool to the touch because the IV fluid is cooler than body temperature and isn't circulating with the blood. There might be pain or discomfort, but it's usually not severe or burning like with a vesicant. Stop the infusion immediately. Remove the catheter. You must restart the IV at a new site. Ideally, choose a different extremity. If you have to use the same extremity, restart it above the infiltration site, avoiding the affected vein.
What about compresses?
The source mentions warm or cold compresses. Clinical practice often uses cold initially to reduce swelling and pain, and warm later to promote absorption, but always check your facility's policy. Elevate the affected extremity.
Prevention involves frequent site assessment, looking for swelling, coolness, pain, redness, and checking for blood return. Although the source notes lack of blood return isn't always definitive.
Correct. Now, extravasation is similar to infiltration, but much more serious. This is when a vesicant or irritant solution or medication infuses into the surrounding tissue.
Vesicants, those cause severe tissue damage.
Yes, vesicants are chemicals that can cause severe tissue damage, blistering, and even necrosis. This is why knowing which medications are vesicants is absolutely non-negotiable for 5E certified nurses.
What does extravasation look like compared to infiltration?
It's similar in that the area swells, but it's often accompanied by significant pain or burning, blistering, inflammation. And depending on the medication, signs of tissue necrosis might start to appear relatively quickly.
Management for extravasation is much more urgent.
Yes. Stop the infusion immediately. Notify the provider immediately. Management can involve specific antidotes injected into the tissue around the site, depending on the medication.
Do you remove the catheter?
The source states to remove the catheter based on policy. Some policies might have you leave it in briefly to attempt aspiration of residual drug, while others say pull it immediately. You must restart the IV on a different extremity. Do not attempt to use the same extremity until it has been thoroughly assessed and cleared.
Compresses.
Apply warm or cold compresses based specifically on the medication guidelines and facility policy, as the treatment varies widely depending on the vesicant. Perform frequent neurovascular assessments distal to the site.
Prevention for extravasation is paramount. Use incompatibility charts for medications. Monitor the 5E site very frequently, especially when infusing known vesicants. Use the smallest catheter possible inserted into the largest, most appropriate vein to reduce pressure on the vessel wall.
Then there's thrombophlebitis. That's the presence of a clot and inflammation in the vein.
Signs include localized pain, redness, warmth, swelling, limited movement of the extremity, and a sluggish flow rate. You might also see systemic signs like fever, malaise, and an elevated white blood cell count if there's infection.
Management is to stop the infusion, apply a cold compress initially followed by a warm one, elevate the extremity, and restart the IV at a new site. Crucially, do not flush the line if you suspect a clot, as you could dislodge it.
What if you suspect infection?
Consider culturing the catheter tip upon removal if infection is suspected. Prevention involves gentle technique during insertion to avoid trauma to the vein and frequent site monitoring.
Hematoma is when blood leaks out of the vein and into the surrounding tissues, usually during insertion or removal.
Right. This causes bruising, ecchymosis, swelling at the site, and sometimes blood leaking from the insertion point.
Management.
Stop P the infusion. Remove the needle catheter. Apply pressure to the site to stop the bleeding. Apply ice to help reduce swelling and bruising, and elevate the extremity. Restart the four at a new site on another extremity. Assess for any compromise to circulation, sensation, or movement below the site.
Prevention involves careful insertion technique and monitoring.
Finally, clotting and obstruction. This is when a clot forms inside the IV line or catheter itself.
You'll see a decreased or stopped flow rate, or you might notice blood backflowing into the tubing, especially if you lower the IV bag below the level of the IV site.
Management is simple and critical. Stop the infusion and remove the needle catheter. Do not attempt to irrigate the line or milk the tubing. Do not attempt to aspirate the clot. Any attempt to manipulate the clot could potentially send it into the patient's circulation. Prevention involves not letting the IV bag run dry, ensuring the tubing isn't kinked, maintaining an adequate flow rate, and flushing the line before and after intermittent use.
So monitoring IV sites is not just a checklist item. It requires constant vigilance, knowing the signs of these complications, and knowing the immediate priority interventions to prevent harm. These are fundamental bedside skills you will use every day.
Absolutely. Okay, we've covered fluid volume imbalances and IV therapy management. Now let's dive into the specific electrolyte imbalances detailed in the source. Knowing these electrolytes and their normal ranges is step one to recognizing when something is wrong.
Right. The source mentions ABGs, arterial blood gases, are assessed with some imbalances, indicating their connection to acid-base balance, but doesn't go into interpreting them here, so we'll focus on the electrolyte specifics.
Good plan. First up, sodium, NO+. This is the major extracellular cation, crucial for regulating fluid volume and for nerve and muscle function. Normal serum sodium is typically 135 to 145 milliEQL.
Hyponatremia is low serum sodium, typically less than 135 milliEQL. The source differentiates between acute and chronic.
Yes, acute is often seen with rapid fluid overload, like a post-op patient getting too much hypotonic IV fluid. Chronic is seen more outside the hospital with longer duration and often less severe neurologic effects.
It also highlights exercise-associated hyponatremia.
Right, seen especially in smaller stature women in extreme temperatures or with excessive fluid intake or prolonged exercise where people dilute their sodium by drinking large amounts of plain water.
Pathophysiology involves an imbalance of water versus sodium. Either you're losing too much sodium
from vomiting, diarrhea, heavy sweating, diuretics, adrenal insufficiency,
or holding on to too much water, diluting the sodium,
like from certain medications or a condition called SIADH, where too much ADH is released.
Clinical manifestations can vary. You might see poor skin turgor, dry mucous membranes, headache, decreased salivation, maybe decreased blood pressure, and GI symptoms like nausea and abdominal cramping.
But the most critical manifestations, especially with acute or severe hyponatremia, are neurologic changes.
Because sodium is key to nerve function and fluid shifts in the brain.
Exactly. You can see anything from lethargy, confusion, and disorientation to muscle twitching, seizures, and coma. Serum sodium levels are the definitive diagnostic.
Medical management aims to treat the underlying cause. It might involve giving sodium replacement, oral or FE.
Or if the cause is too much water, restricting fluid intake. Sometimes medications are used to help the body excrete water.
In nursing management.
Crucial. Monitor INO closely, track daily weight, and watch those lab values. Sodium, serum osmolality. Vigilantly monitor the patient for any and all CNS changes. This is the priority assessment because severe hyponatremia can cause life-threatening brain swelling.
Okay.
Encourage dietary sodium if appropriate and closely monitor fluid intake, especially if fluid restriction is ordered. Be aware of medications the patient is taking that can affect sodium.
Hypernatremia is high serum sodium, typically greater than 145 milliEQL. This can occur with normal fluid volume, FED or FEE.
Pathophysiology is often due to fluid deprivation, people simply not drinking enough water, which is very common in elderly or debilitated patients. It can also be from excessive sodium intake, IV or oral, massive water losses that aren't replaced, like in diabetes insipidus, heat stroke, or receiving hypertonic IV solutions.
Clinical manifestations often include thirst, which the source calls a primary symptom, and elevated body temperature. Again, neurologic changes are prominent.
Yes, but different from hyponatremia here, you might see restlessness, weakness, disorientation, delusions, hallucinations, or seizures as brain cells shrink.
Diagnostics.
Key diagnostics include serum osmolality greater than 300 millosim KOK and increased urine-specific gravity and osmolality as the kidneys try to conserve water.
Medical management involves gradually lowering the serum sodium using hypotonic electrolyte solutions, often 0.45% ACL. Diuretics may also be used. Gradual correction is essential.
Absolutely, to prevent rapid fluid shifts that can be dangerous to the brain. Nursing management includes assessing for reasons the patient isn't taking in enough water or is losing too much. Check for hidden sources of sodium. And again, monitor for CNS changes very closely. Rapid shifts, whether up or down, are dangerous.
Next, potassium, K+. Yeah. The major intracellular cation, crucial for nerve and muscle function, especially the heart. Normal serum potassium is typically 3.5 to 5.0 milliQL.
Hypokalemia is low serum potassium, usually less than 3.5 milliQL. And the source points out you can have a normal total body potassium but still have hypokalemia if potassium shifts into the cells, like in alkalosis.
Pathophysiology often involves significant GI losses from vomiting, diarrhea, suctioning, ileostomies.
Right. Medications like diuretics, loop and thiazide, and corticosteroids are common culprits. Alkalosis causes that intracellular shift. Poor dietary intake can contribute, as can conditions like hyperaldosteronism.
Clinical manifestations can be life-threatening, primarily impacting the heart. ECG changes are key.
Yes, key diagnostic findings and require immediate attention: flattened T waves, prominent U waves, and ST segment depression. These can lead to dangerous, even fatal, dysrhythmias.
Other signs:
dilute urine and excessive thirst, fatigue, anorexia, muscle weakness, which can affect respiratory muscles, decreased bowel motility, potentially leading to an ileus, and paresthesia, tingling.
Medical management involves potassium replacement, diet, oral supplements.
And for severe deficits, IV potassium is necessary, but the source stresses it should only be given if adequate urine output is established. You need functioning kidneys to excrete excess potassium and prevent hyperkalemia.
And IV potassium administration has strict safety rules.
Non-negotiable rules. Never give IV potassium push. It can cause immediate cardiac arrest. It must be administered slowly, diluted in IV fluids, and often requires an infusion pump to control the rate.
Nursing manager.
Monitor the ECG for changes. Monitor ABGs and be extra vigilant if the patient is on digitalis, as hypokalemia increases the risk of digitalis toxicity. Confirm adequate urine output before administering 5V potassium.
Hyperkalemia is high serum potassium, typically greater than 5.0 NaQL, less common with normal renal function.
Much less common because healthy kidneys efficiently excrete potassium. The risk is significantly increased in older adults due to age-related decreased renal function and common medications they take.
The source notes that cardiac arrest is frequently associated with hyperkalemia, making this a medical emergency.
Absolutely. Pathophysiology is most commonly impaired renal function. Other causes include rapid IV potassium administration, hypoaldosteronism, medications like potassium-sparing diuretics, ACE inhibitors, NSAIDs, tissue trauma releasing intracellular K+ IOs, or acidosis causing K+ to shift out of cells.
Clinical manifestations again center on the heart.
Yes, cardiac changes and dysrhythmias are the primary concern. Peak T waves, often the first sign, a widened QRS complex, potentially progressing to a sine wave pattern and a systole.
Also muscle weakness, paresthesias, anxiety, GI symptoms.
Right, like cramping and diarrhea.
Yeah.
ECG changes and metabolic respiratory acidosis are key diagnostics.
Medical management depends on the severity. Mild cases involve limiting dietary potassium. What about severe cases?
Cation exchange resins like kyoxalate can bind potassium in the gut. For emergent severe hyperkalemia, interventions include IV calcium gluconate to stabilize the heart.
But it doesn't lower potassium.
Correct. Then IV sodium bicarbonate to shift K+ into cells. IV regular insulin along with hypertonic dextrose insulin drives K+ into cells. Dextrose prevents hypoglycemia. Beta-2 agonists like albuterol can also cause intracellular shift and hemodialysis, which is the most effective way to rapidly remove potassium.
Nursing management for hyperkalemia is all about cardiac vigilance.
Monitor ECG, heart rate, apical pulse, and blood pressure closely. Assess labs, monitor INO. Dietary teaching is vital. If administering emergent IV meds, do so slowly with an infusion pump.
Moving to calcium, Ca2+, essential for bone health, nerves, muscles, clotting. Normal serum calcium is typically 8.5 to 10.5 mg/dL, but you need to consider albumin levels, right?
Yes, because much calcium is bound to albumin. So, serum calcium levels need to be considered in relation to albumin, or ideally you look at the ionized calcium level, which is the active form. Calcium is regulated by parathyroid hormone, PTH, and calcitonin.
Hypocalcemia is low serum calcium, less than 8.5 mg/dL or low ionized calcium.
Pathophysiology includes hypoparathyroidism, since PTH raises blood calcium, malabsorption issues like vitamin D deficiency, pancreatitis, alkalosis, transfusion of citrated blood, kidney injury, certain medications. Osteoporosis is mentioned, but affects bone density more than acute serum levels.
Clinical manifestations often highlight neuromuscular irritability, tetany.
Involuntary muscle spasms, often the first sign. Patients might report circumoral numbness around the mouth and paresthesia, tingling. Hyperactive deep tendon reflexes, DTRs, are common.
And those classic signs, trousseau and Frostek.
Yes, trousseau sign carpal spasm with a BP cuff. Schwostek sign facial twitching when tapping the facial nerve. Seizures can occur. Respiratory symptoms like dyspnea and laryngospasm are dangerous, potentially life-threatening. Abnormal clotting, anxiety too. Ionized calcium levels are most reliable.
Medical management involves calcium replacement. 4V calcium gluconate for emergent situations.
Right, but monitor the IV site carefully. It's an irritant. Oral calcium and vitamin D supplements for chronic hypercalcemia. Weight-bearing exercises help decrease bone calcium loss.
Nursing management includes instituting seizure precautions, patient teaching about diet and supplements. Monitor that IV site carefully if giving calcium gluconate.
Hypercalcemia is high serum calcium, typically greater than 10.5 mg/dL. Mild might be asymptomatic, but hypercalcemia crisis is life-threatening.
What causes it?
The two most common causes highlighted are malignancy cancer and hyperparathyroidism. Prolonged immobility causing bone resorption and certain diuretics like thiazides can also contribute.
Clinical manifestations involve multiple systems: polyuria, thirst, muscle weakness, intractable nausea, abdominal cramps, severe constipation or diarrhea, right, peptic ulcer disease, bone pain.
And ECG changes and dysrhythmias can also be present.
Medical management. Treat the underlying cause.
Yes, like treating the cancer. Often administer large amounts of 5E fluids, normal saline, to dilute calcium and promote excretion. Loop diuretics like furosemide after hydration. Medications like phosphates, calcitonin, and bisphosphonates inhibit bone resorption.
Nursing management focuses on encouraging increased mobility if possible. Encourage high fluid intake, 3 to 4 liters a day unless contraindicated, to prevent kidney stones and aid excretion. Dietary teaching involves avoiding calcium-rich foods, increasing fiber, ensure patient safety due to weakness or altered mental status.
Magnesium, Mg2+, vital for enzyme activity, neuromuscular function, and influences calcium and potassium levels. Normal serum magnesium is typically 1.8 to 2.5 mg/dL. Hypomagnesemia often goes with hypokalemia and hypocalcemia.
Hypomagnesemia is low serum magnesium, less than 1.8 mg/dL.
Pathophysiology includes alcoholism, a very common cause, GI losses, inadequate magnesium and TPN tube feeds, certain medications like diuretics and some antibiotics, and rapid administration of citrated blood.
Clinical manifestations often mirror hypocalcemia, neuromuscular irritability, Schwostek and trousseau signs.
Also, apathy, depressed mood, psychosis, ataxia, insomnia, confusion, muscle weakness, tremors. ECG changes and dysrhythmias are serious. Ionized serum magnesium is the more accurate diagnostic.
Medical management, 5V magnesium sulfate.
Yes, common for moderate to severe deficits, given carefully via pump. Oral supplements for mild deficits. Calcium gluconate is the antidote if hypermagnesemia occurs during IV administration or for associated hypocalcemic tetany.
Nursing management requires administering high V magnesium sulfate slowly, monitoring vitals, especially respirations and BP, and urine output closely, monitor for dysphagia, institute seizure precautions, dietary teaching about foods high in magnesium, leafy greens, beans, nuts, peanut butter.
Hypermagnesemia is high serum magnesium, typically greater than 2.5 mg/dL. Rare, because healthy kidneys excrete it well. A hemolyzed blood sample can cause a falsely elevated reading.
Pathophysiology is most commonly kidney injury. Also, diabetic ketoacidosis, excessive intake, antacids, laxatives, high VMAG sulfate for preeclampsia, extensive soft tissue injury.
Clinical manifestations are characterized by depressed function. Hypoactive or absent deep tendon reflexes, DTRs, are a key sign. drowsiness, muscle weakness, and critically depressed respirations, which can be life-threatening.
Also ECG changes, dysrhythmias, cardiac arrest potential.
Right. Medical management involves addressing the cause. For severe symptoms, 5-E calcium gluconate is the antidote. Ventilatory support may be needed. Hemodialysis is effective. If renal function allows, loop diuretics, IV sodium chloride, and LR may promote excretion.
Nursing management includes educating patients to avoid magnesium-containing meds. Frequently assess DTRs and LOC. Monitor respiratory status, closely critical safety assessment.
Phosphorus, phosphate, PO43. Essential for bone, ATP, nucleic acids. Normal serum phosphorus is typically 2.5 to 4.5 mgDL. It has an inverse relationship with calcium, regulated by PTH, vitamin D, calcitonin.
Hypophosphatemia is low serum phosphorus, below 2.5 mgDL, can happen due to shifts into cells.
Yes, even if total body stores are normal. Pathophysiology includes alcoholism, refeeding syndrome, pain, heat stroke, respiratory alkalosis hyperventilation, DKA, hepatic encephalopathy, major burns, hyperparathyroidism, low magnesium potassium, diarrhea, vitamin D deficiency, use of diuretics and phosphate binding antacids.
Clinical manifestations are primarily neurologic symptoms. Irritability, confusion, delirium, seizures, coma, also muscle weakness, including respiratory muscles, tissue hypoxia, muscle and bone pain, increased infection risk. Diagnostics include serum phosphorus, maybe urine studies, PTH levels.
Medical management focuses on prevention, especially avoiding aggressive refeeding. Oral or IV phosphorus replacement 5-E is slow and cautious, only for very low levels, risk of hypocalcemia, correcting the underlying cause.
Nursing management involves monitoring the IV site for extravasation. Monitor phosphorus, vitamin D, and calcium levels. Encourage high phosphorus foods, milk, organ meats, beans, nuts, fish, poultry. Gradually introduce calories for malnourished patients on TPN to prevent refeeding syndrome.
Hyperphosphatemia is high serum phosphorus above 4.5 mgDL. Increased intake, decreased excretion, most common, or shifts out of cells.
Pathophysiology is most commonly kidney injury. Also, excess intake, laxatives, enemas, IV phosphate, excess vitamin D, acidosis, hypoparathyroidism, chemotherapy, tumor lysis.
Clinical manifestations are often few from the high phosphate itself. Symptoms usually arise from the associated hypocalcemia like tetany. Long prone, soft tissue calcifications can occur. Diagnostics, serum phosphorus, decreased PTH, BUN, creatinine.
Medical management treats the underlying disorder. Maybe vitamin D preps cautiously. Calcium binding antacids or phosphate binders with meals. Loop diuretics and IV fluids if kidneys work. Dialysis for severe cases.
Nursing management includes monitoring phosphorus and calcium closely. Advise patients to avoid high phosphorus foods and phosphate containing substances. Educate them on signs of hypocalcemia.
Finally, chloride, Cl, major extracellular anion. Works with sodium, involved in acid-base balance, inverse to bicarb, needed for stomach acid. Aldosterone affects reabsorption, mainly from diet, salt. Normal is 98 to 106 mUQL.
Hypochloremia is low serum chloride, less than 98 mUQL, often lost with sodium and potassium.
Pathophysiology, Addison disease, reduced intake, GI loss, vomiting, suctioning, diarrhea, DKA, excessive sweating, fever, burns, certain meds, metabolic alkalosis.
Clinical manifestations, agitation, irritability, weakness, muscle hyperexcitability, dysrhythmia, seizures, coma. ABGs may show metabolic alkalosis.
Medical management.
Yeah.
Replace chloride, often with IV normal saline, 0.9% or 0.45% ACL, maybe ammonium chloride and metabolic alkalosis.
Nursing management, monitor INO, ABGs, electrolytes, assess LOC. Educate about high chloride foods, tomato juice, bananas, eggs, cheese, milk. Advise avoiding large amounts of plain water.
Hyperchloremia is high serum chloride, more than 106 LEEQL, often with hypernatremia, bicarbonate loss, metabolic acidosis.
Pathophysiology is frequently iatrogenically induced, caused by medical treatment, most commonly large amounts of 0.9% normal saline. Kidney injury can also contribute.
Clinical manifestations, tachypnea, lethargy, weakness, rapid deep respirations. Kussmaul if acidosis is significant. Hypertension, cognitive changes. Diagnostics, serum chloride, potassium, ABGs, metabolic acidosis, maybe urine chloride, anion gap might be normal.
Medical management, correct the cause. May switch IV fluids away from normal saline to something like lactated Ringer's. Sodium bicarbonate for acidosis. Diuretics to enhance excretion.
Nursing management. Monitor INO and ABGs. Focus respiratory, neuro, cardiac assessments. Patient teaching on diet and hydration.
So as we've seen, the body's fluid and electrolyte balance is incredibly complex. Intricate regulation, widespread effects when things go wrong. Each electrolyte plays multiple roles. Imbalances manifest across almost every body system. It's a constant reminder of how interconnected everything is.
Absolutely. And for you learning or practicing nursing, this deep dive into the source material really highlights the fundamental nature of this knowledge. We've covered everything from the basic fluid compartments and how substances move to the body's sophisticated regulatory systems, the specific signs of both fluid volume and individual electrolyte imbalances, the medical treatments, and critically, the vital nursing interventions and assessments you perform at the bedside.
We've emphasized how crucial your observation skills are, whether it's carefully monitoring IV sites to prevent complications, recognizing subtle changes in an older adult that might signal dehydration, or picking up on the key signs like ECG changes with potassium imbalances or neuromuscular signs with calcium issues.
Understanding these concepts isn't just about passing an exam. It directly impacts your ability to provide safe, effective, and proactive care. It's about developing that clinical intuition that allows you to anticipate potential problems, recognize them early, and respond quickly and appropriately to prevent patient harm.
This deep dive reinforces that being a truly well-informed nurse means connecting the underlying physiology with the assessment findings you gather and the interventions you implement. It's about seeing the whole picture of the patient.
And that leads us to a thought to leave you with, something to ponder after this deep dive. Given how interconnected fluid and electrolyte imbalances are, how they can be caused by so many different factors, medications, illnesses, even our own treatments, and how they can manifest differently in various patients, especially those with multiple comorbidities or age-related changes. How does this comprehensive understanding challenge you to approach every patient assessment, regardless of their primary complaint, with a lens of vigilance for potential fluid and electrolyte issues?
Consider the seemingly unrelated symptoms a patient might have and how they could potentially be connected back to this fundamental balance. How does this knowledge prompt you to ask different questions or perform different assessments?
Keep exploring, keep learning, and keep diving deep into what makes the human body tick.